pause number 13240166CV. The Gala Special Events LTD and Victor Barrera versus Christian Tejerina and Joe Zacharias.
It please the court. My name is Katie Klein, and I'm here representing the appellees in this case. This case has a sort of an unusual history, but I'm probably going to want to spend most of my time talking about the elements of the DTPA claim, since that is the one that went to the jury. What is interesting about this case is that the disagreement occurred because of a governmental order, which was a shutdown order during COVID. What had happened was we are here from a failure to grant an NOV in favor of the appellees because of the fact that this is a case involving producing cause. And producing cause has to be the element of damages. And in this case, I think you will conclude that the damages were caused by COVID, not by my clients. These parties were engaged to be married, and they were having a baby, and Ms. Tejerina was looking for a venue. It's important to remember that the only cause of action that they got a finding on was unconscionable course of conduct. An unconscionable course of conduct requires that the person situated as the appellees are guilty of taking advantage of the lack of skill, knowledge, and ability of the other party. And that's the central element.
And why wouldn't a contract such as this, which the court found to be illusory, where I cancel it, you cancel it, anybody can cancel it, I never get my money back?
Well, because as a matter of law, the case law says that if both parties have performed, it is, as a matter of law, not an illusory contract. So that as the Court of Appeals, you cannot change that law. Well, presumably, I guess you could. But the outstanding law says that if both parties have performed, that it's an illusory contract. But more importantly,
How did Gala perform?
How Gala performed was that they provided the venue, they gave them alternate dates, and the critical piece of evidence is that then the appellees said, okay, we'll take those dates. And they were not going to charge them any more fees. They didn't charge them any more fees. They didn't ask for anything. They said, we'll give you dates.
Ask for a new contract.
I'm sorry?
They did ask for a new contract.
Yes, they did. And the parties refused to sign it, but they still gave them dates. They gave them dates within 6 months. They gave them dates in July, August, September, and October. The parties didn't want those dates. Some were Fridays, some were Sundays. And so they gave them the dates in February of 2021. Everything seemed to be going according to an agreement to substitute a date, since neither party was responsible for the May 2nd, 2022 debacle because of the stay-at-home order issued by the government. So they gave them new dates. They attempted to mitigate their damages, and that's one of the elements in unconscionable course of conduct, that it has to be glaringly unfair and unmitigated. They attempted to mitigate without charging them any fees. They gave them other dates. It's also important to know that in 2019, when the parties were negotiating the contract, that Ms. Tejerina actually negotiated another contract for her baby shower, and her baby shower took place without any incident. If these people were horrible people that are trying to take advantage of them, then certainly they would not have gone through one successful event already. But it's also important to know that Ms. Tejerina had already indicated she wanted to cancel the May date because even though it was 8 months ahead of time, she said she had just had a baby and she hadn't lost enough weight and she was afraid that her dress wasn't going to fit. So she was already having doubts about the May date. But even so, that was resolved by the fact that the government would not let them go forward. And so our people, the appellees, the appellants were willing to give them other dates, not charge them anything, and even gave them Saturday dates, which is what they wanted.
Is there any case law that would support finding that the relationship or the past relationship of the parties would go to show that it's
Not that I have found. I can look for that specifically, but the important point is that it is impossible to take the position that these were uneducated, unskilled, unsophisticated contract persons, because Ms. Tijerina had a degree in accounting, and she also was involved in the house flipping business. She was buying properties, she was renovating them, and she was selling them. So she dealt with contracts all the time. And Dr. Zacharias was a dentist who had a business where he does veneers, he does cosmetic dentistry, but he's a very successful gentleman, which also brings up another issue, that he claims that he paid the $16,750, and he didn't. It was the PA that paid it. So how can he then turn around and recover as an individual, and the PA did not join as a party? That's another problem that they have. But on the day that she negotiated the contract, Dr. Zacharias read the contract, and she paid the $500 fee. Actually, he came down and paid the $500 fee. So he also had an opportunity to ask about anything he wanted to know. But nevertheless, she had the party before in August, and they had no problems. They had planned a wedding for May the 2nd for 300 guests, and her shower was October the 5th, 2019. In November 2019 was when she said she wanted to change the date because her dress wasn't going to fit her. I mean, it begs the question that she had 7 months to lose the weight. But in any event, that was concerning her in November of 2019. And so Zacharias paid $16,075 as a PA on February 28, 2020. Sadly, the shelter-in-place order was enacted in April of 2020, and the new dates were agreed upon. And in fact, to answer Justice Fonseca's question, the record is clear that my clients offered the money back. They offered to give them a full refund, but the appellees said, no, we want $70,000. Now, ordinarily, that would be settlement discussions.
But wasn't that part of the testimony that your client was offering to the jury? And the court instructed the jury not to consider that because it was part of a settlement negotiation.
Your Honor is correct, but Mr. Franz did not ask for a motion to strike, so that testimony was never stricken record. So it exists in the record, and the jury considered it, presumably, because it was not stricken from the record, and we are bound by those rules. But they offered all of their money back. And the most important thing is that in April of 2020, which was a month before the scheduled date, the appellees asked for $34,575. That's before the event was even supposed to take place. So there was overreaching on the part of the appellees when, in fact, there is an undisputed defensive impossibility related to the May 2nd date. And that was established as a matter of law, we would assert. It's interesting that of all six claims that were argued and were pleaded, they prevailed on one. Only one was prevailed on. Two went to the jury, and on false, misleading, or deceptive practices, the jury found none. They found no misrepresentation effect. So as a matter of law, that puts this case back in a breach of contract posture, not a DTPA posture, because there was not a misrepresentation. And if you're talking about a breach of contract, look at the damages that were awarded. The damages that were awarded were exactly the contract damages. It was the amount of the potential refund, the amount that they had paid. That is not DTPA measure of damages. There was no emotional anguish. There was no emotional distress. This is not a DTPA case. And the Crawford case out of the Texas Supreme Court in 1998 states unequivocally, if all you have is a breach of contract, you cannot recast that as a DTPA case. And so as a matter of law, this case fails because it is nothing more than a breach of contract at most. And the court granted a directed verdict on fraud, which means the court also found there was no misrepresentation. The court granted a motion for directed verdict on breach of contract. So the court said there was no breach of contract here as a matter of law, and on promissory estoppel. On November 16, the court signed this order saying this is an illusory contract, sua sponte, at the conclusion of the plaintiff's case, without hearing any evidence from the defendant about how the defendant performed. So clearly, as a matter of law, the court erred in sua sponte issuing this order, before the plaintiffs had an opportunity to present their evidence.
They abandoned that, the breach of
contract. That's my point. So then, finally, the court understood that this was an improper finding. And so these your honors should not change that finding because both parties did perform. The mitigation by my clients was, in fact, offering new dates, giving them Saturday dates, offering them a refund.
But counsel, isn't it true that your client offered a future date on the condition of signing a new agreement along with a cancellation form? That was not part of the original agreement.
They asked for them to sign the contract. When they refused because their lawyer said not to, they were still willing to perform. If you look at the dates, they were still willing to perform in February of 21. So asking them to sign the contract itself is not an unconscionable act because it's not taking advantage of their lack of skill or knowledge. These were very savvy people. As you can tell, my clients didn't even speak English, and they had borrowed a contract from someone else. If there's anybody who lacked skill and savvy, it was obviously the appellants because they were not educated like these people were. They were professional people. They knew what they were doing. But the other thing that's very important here is that unconscionable action was not supported by evidence, and there was no breach of contract. But more importantly, the big chunk of damages in this case is Mr. Franz's attorney's fees. He's asked for $85,000, and that's what the jury awarded. But he failed to segregate his attorney's fees. And as a matter of law, his attorney's fee award cannot stand because you have to segregate the recoverable items from the non-recoverable items. And this court's considering other cases that deal with that particular issue. But again, if the court were to determine that the waiver provision was unconscionable, then the remedy is to strike that provision from the contract, not to throw out the contract. And the court ruled as a matter of law that there was no breach of the contract. So where does that leave you? It leaves you with no place to hang your hat on because of the fact that even if you struck out that unconscionability provision, it wouldn't change the argument. It would not change the verdict because the problem that they have is that the issue of failure to include the waiver provision, and again, remember we have briefed the fact that he allowed those posters to sit up during the whole trial implying that every contract had to have that provision in it when that was not the law. And finally, at the end of the case, the judge said, well, I guess you're right. I'll take him down. Really? For the jury argument after they've sat up the whole week? I mean, that was totally unfair. But that also doesn't give voice to the fact that the remedy would be to strike only that portion. It's also important that we never received a notice letter on the provision that went to the jury. Never. There were two DTPA notice letters. They only contained laundry list violations. They did not contain notice of what was the claim that went to the jury. So failure to have a notice letter should also work against their attorney's fees. But more importantly, Mr. Franz made no effort to segregate his fees and then briefs it by saying it's appellant's job to do his work. No, that's not how it works. He has a burden to put on evidence. I'm sorry?
Looking at the jury charge in question number 11, it says, do not include fees that relate solely to any other claim.
But there is no evidence on which the jury could rely because in his testimony and in his affidavit, he did not segregate what was recoverable from what was not recoverable. Now, admittedly, the issues that we're complaining about were all conditionally submitted on question number 4. So it all turns on question number 4 because they wouldn't answer the other issues if they had not gotten a yes on number 4. However, for proving up his attorney's fees, the law is quite clear that you must segregate. Now, if the court does not accept our argument and reverse this case and render, then the court's responsibility is to sever the attorney's fees and send it back to the trial court because the court does not have any evidence of what is the recoverable portion and what is the unrecoverable portion.
Now, counsel, if I could ask you a question. It's been a while since I had the attorney's fees litigation in my personal practice. But if I remember correctly, when the attorney's fees come from the same facts and they're commingled in the same facts, you're not required to segregate. Is that correct?
Almost. The principle is that. However, the case law says you have to have evidence of why they are inextricably intertwined, and that that is the burden of the proponent of the attorney's fees, and they failed to meet their burden because they did not offer evidence of what, why they were inextricably intertwined and what was the amount, so that the jury had no alternative but to ask for the $85,000.
Are they required to do that?
I'm sorry?
Are they required to do that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question about that. And it's A.G. Edwards and Sons, and it's Supreme Court of Texas, 2007. But also, the attorney fee award was not conditioned on an unsuccessful appeal, and that's Segredo versus Ball. So I thank you, and I'll reserve my other 5 minutes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. I stand before you as the attorney for Appalachians, Joe Zacarias and Christian Tijerina, a young couple that was looking forward to getting married May 2nd of 2020, a Saturday night, so that family and friends from out of town could make it to the Rio Grande Valley to McAllen to celebrate their wedding. Saturday was important to this couple. I'm going to present the evidence that I ask you consider to affirm the judgment based on the jury's finding that the Gala Special Events Limited engaged in unconscionable action or courses of action that were producing causes of damages to the appellees, a total of $19,575.
What is that unconscionable action?
I'm about to get into that, Judge. The unconscionable action starts with my client, Christian Tijerina, arriving at the gala on July 31st at 2019 at 4:30 in the afternoon. She falls in love with the place because it is a beautiful place. And she starts talking about dates and finds out May 2nd is available. So what happens at that point is she says, okay, well, let me go talk to my husband. And Ms. Barrera whips out a form, which is Exhibit 2 in your binder. And she says, well, you know what? It just happens we have a promotion that expires today. And if you give us $500 and sign the contract today, you get to save $3,000. I'd ask you to look at Exhibit 2 in your binder. My client didn't know this at the time, but nothing on Exhibit 2 indicates that there's a promotion expiring July 31st of 2019. This is a pre-printed form that they whip out anytime a customer comes in to induce them to sign a contract quickly. Look at the fine print, the note at the bottom just above the initials. These prices are only for 2018. That indicates this form was created long before my clients ever showed up. So this is where the transaction, the unconscionability, the trickery begins. So my client is excited to save $3,000. She calls her husband, and they deposit a $500 deposit and begin to make payments for the next 8 or 9 months. Now we'll get into unconscionability. And there's a case, there's a Houston Livestock Show versus Hamrick case that talks about you look at the entire transaction when you're evaluating unconscionability. It's just not one particular point in time.
But the transaction is the signing of the contract?
No, it's the provision. The transaction is the payment for a wedding reception on May 2nd over the course of close to a year, not a year, but 8 or 9 months, and provision of those services.
Okay. But what are you hanging your hat on? It's the inducement that you just referred to on the exhibit? Is it the contract itself?
Let's look at the unconscionable conduct, the misrepresentations. Look at Exhibit 1, the first page. A couple of observations here. It's not signed by Mr. Zacarias. So to the extent that the gala wants to rely on contract language to deny him a refund, they have no basis because he didn't sign this agreement.
Is it even signed by gala?
No.
I couldn't find it on the record.
Because they, I'm sorry?
I couldn't find
it
on the record.
No, it wasn't signed by the gala, but a couple of other observations. The Gala Special Events Limited does not appear as a party to this contract. Nowhere in this contract, 9 pages, will you find the Gala Special Events LTD. What you will see at the bottom is references to the Gala Investors Limited and a general partner, Galo's Management LLC. The trial court testimony was these are non-existent entities that never existed.
2 points on that. Your briefing does not address that at all.
It is in the statement of facts, Your Honor.
Granted, but there's no argument as to whether or not that was what was presented to the jury. Is that what the jury was basing the decision off of? One and two. I mean, I'll let you respond.
Oh, I'm sorry. I may not have understood your question, but what I'm saying is the jury had an opportunity, and this was discussed, to understand how these folks do business. They present contracts that don't have their name. They include parties that don't exist. And then they try to enforce unconscionable language on clients. And I'm going to get to that.
Go ahead, Ms. Justice.
The counsel, you heard the appellants argue that your clients had previously signed a similar contract.
No, that was later. They signed the wedding shower contract afterwards. Not my clients, Christian Tijerina, Mr. Zacarias, to my knowledge, did not. And that was not evidence in the case. The actual contract was not offered in evidence. That was another event that went off without a hitch. If you'll allow me, the problem arises when we get to the language that the Gala relied on to deny my clients a refund, and that's found on page 7. And if you look at Exhibit 1A, this was what the jury viewed, and we think it's unconscionable, and the jury believed is unconscionable. If you look at page 7, the highlighted portions, you'll see there a provision. The Gala, under subsection 1, the Gala terminates for any reason the scheduled special event, the client losses automatically all deposits, security deposits, and any other payments made up to the date of the cancellation or termination. This is what the Gala relied on to tell my clients, you lose. This provision right here. But let's see what conditions precedent are required before that comes into play.
It wasn't the force majeure clause?
I'm asking you to look above that. When do sections 1, 2, and 3 come into play? And if you look at the middle under the Gala liquidated damages, customer, who are my clients, therefore agrees that if the special event at the premises is, for any reason, canceled by the customer, so if my clients cancel, they lose. That's understood and that's clear. Or if the Gala terminates the contract pursuant to a right to terminate the contract for non-payment, if my clients don't pay on time or as promised, my clients lose. Those are the only two conditions where subsections 1, 2, or 3 can be applied. And what they did is they took a situation where my clients paid in full 2 months before the wedding reception. And then COVID happens through no fault of my clients. And the Gala says, you're out. You lose. Because this says, if the Gala terminates for any reason, COVID, force majeure, whatever, you lose your money. And that's unconscionable. And that's why we fought. And that's why we're here.
So, counsel, why were your clients still pursuing a refund if there were future dates offered?
Again, now if we look at Exhibit 47, the cancellation letter, I disagree with the record. The evidence is clear, and my clients both testified, and it's in the statement of facts. The alternate dates were contingent on them signing the cancellation form. They consulted with an attorney, Mr. Izaguirre, and because of this clause, we agree and fully accept that the deposit and all payments given are not refundable in accordance to the policy and signed contract at the Gala special events. The lawyer said, don't sign that. And because my clients didn't follow their lawyer's advice, they didn't get an alternate date. But it's within their right. The original contract that we looked at, it didn't give the Gala the right to keep the money because those two conditions precedent never occurred. My clients paid and my clients didn't cancel.
So are you relying on the contract or not? Because
I'm using the contract to show that it's unconscionable. It's an unconscionable course of action to take people's money, get paid in advance, not spend a dime on their event, and then say, you lose because of this clause in a contract. It's not a breach of contract. It's unconscionable business practice. That was our argument, and that's what the record shows. The way they do business, unfairly and grossly, you know, took advantage of my clients. My client's a dentist, and one works as real estate. How are they supposed to know? How do they have knowledge that subsections 1, 2, and 3 are going to be applied and used against them to deny them a refund when they've paid in full and they didn't cancel the agreement? Who would be sophisticated enough to know that the gala was going to do that? But they did it. They took those few words and they said, if for any reason we can, even if we cancel, you lose. And that was the crux of the case, Your Honors.
But even if we agreed with you that this was an unconscionable action, how is it a producing cause? That's the other issue here. Because it seems the record seems to indicate that the cancellation wasn't because the gala simply didn't want to perform. The state prohibited the gala from moving forward with the event.
In support of that, Victor and Saida Barrera, here's the evidence, owned and operated the gala since 2012 and used that same contract with that language. Saida Barrera and her husband Victor knew the contract was one-sided in favor of the gala before she even met Christian Ticanina. Saida Barrera knew the contract contained waivers of consumer rights that were not conspicuously placed in the 9-page agreement. More importantly, she knew that the language on page 7 under the gala liquidated damages, she knew what that meant before she met my client. She did not disclose that when she got my client's signature. We've gone over the reasons why it doesn't apply, but they had all of this notice at the time. What they told my clients, and it's in the record, they said, the only way you lose your money is if you cancel or you ask for another date, because we're holding this date for you. And if you change it, you're out. My clients understood that. What they did, what was unconscionable at the time she's inducing my client, Christian Tijerina, to sign this agreement, what's unconscionable is she's not saying, oh, by the way, we've had this language in this deal that gives us a right to keep your money if we cancel or rebook another, you know, somebody comes in and wants your date. We have the right to keep all of that. And so that was what we presented to the jury.
Counsel, could you help me to understand the issue of attorney's fees? Counsel suggested that you needed to segregate them.
My response to that is all of these claims were part and parcel of showing unconscionable conduct. When we alleged fraud, one of the allegations was you failed to disclose. And as the court must know, a failure to disclose material information can be considered fraud if it induces somebody to sign something.
But the trial court granted a directed verdict on those causes of action. So if the trial court found there wasn't any evidence of a misrepresentation, for example, then how can you say that that would now support the DTPA claim on that ground?
I disagree with the trial court on the fraud decision. However, because we presented evidence of misrepresentation, failure to disclose, things that I felt served to help prove a fraud, they also served the purpose of adding to the unconscionable course of action that this business engaged in. Not disclosing material information, not disclosing language embedded in a contract, which gave them, you're out. None of that. So that went in with that. I'm trying to think. The breach of contract, part of the unconscionability here is that they paid for a venue on May 2nd. They didn't get what they paid for. And while that is, those elements are part of breach of contract, that was also necessary to show that once they got to that point where the gala could not perform, then it's unconscionable to say, let's go back to this contract. And you're out because there's a provision in here that allows me to keep your money when we don't perform for any reason. And we argued that was unconscionable. So the evidence served both purposes. And we didn't want to assert breach of contract because they had a defense. The reason they couldn't perform was because of COVID, but that did not entitle them to keep our clients' money or to force our clients to take a Friday or a Sunday a year later along with requiring them to sign a cancellation which waived their rights to a refund. So the Tony Gullo case, it's a Texas Supreme Court case, and that stands for the proposition that you can, in fact, bring a breach of contract and a DTPA claim. And in this case, we're asking you to affirm the DTPA violation finding of unconscionability. We think the record is factually and legally sufficient. The evidence is there to affirm the trial court's judgment. I was cross-examined by attorney Reggie Richardson at length about my work. The only issue of segregation that came up during that examination is how would I divide up the fees if requested, and I would say half for Mr. Zacarias and half for my client. There was no question about work that was unnecessary. You have Exhibit 54B that has my time records, and I testified that $300 an hour was reasonable. I had more hours, 325 at the time of trial. The jury decided that $85,000 was fair. The evidence supports the award.
And could you respond to Ms. Klein's statement? She said that you failed to give a proper DTPA notice to support the attorney fee award.
The DTPA notice, and I am clear in memory, there were two DPA notices, one sent by Mr. Izaguirre and one that I sent later. But they all asserted unconscionable conduct on the part of the Gala, and that put the Gala on notice that we would be bringing a DTPA claim in addition to other things like misrepresentation and laundry list items. But the notice letters and the pleadings from the onset asserted unconscionability. There was no objection at trial to any of the notice letters. They were admitted without objection. And after those letters were offered and admitted, I think I had already rested my case, and there was that testimony about settlement negotiations. I do recall the court instructing the jury to disregard. I do not believe I'm mistaken on that. Ms. Klein said that the record was not stricken. I do recall the judge instructing the jury. I'll go back and look at the record, but I'm pretty certain that happened. The important thing is, if there was any error at that point, it was waived when appellant's counsel objected to the granting of the mistrial. They had a chance to do a do-over, and they said, no, let's continue, even after Judge Nelson indicated he was declaring a mistrial. And so we went forward. So I think there's a strong waiver argument. If they have anything to complain about regarding evidence, lack of evidence, things like that, they waived it.
Counsel, at what point during this case were the claims against Mr. Barreda dismissed?
I think they were dismissed at the trial. I'm not quite sure. I think we just didn't present issues on Mr. Barreda, as I recall. The appellants did not request a jury issue. Mr. Barreda was not seeking affirmative relief. And it's my opinion in the briefing we submit indicates that whether a person is a prevailing party or not, that's left to the discretion of the trial court. And in light of the letter that Mr. Barreda wrote, which is Exhibit 47, not 47, it's 52 in your binder. This will be a brief response to what Ms. Klein indicated about his clients not being sophisticated, not knowing what the contract said. In Exhibit 52, he's quick to point out the language on page 7 of the contract as to why my clients lose. He does it on two occasions on the first page of the letter that he authored on April 10th, very early on in the process. But he ends with, if you take this to court, you're going to lose and you're going to be paying our attorney's fees. So he was an active participant in this unconscionable conduct, as we alleged, and the trial court had the discretion to decide that he was not a prevailing party since he was an owner of the Gala and the jury had found that the Gala engaged in an unconscionable course of action. which was a producing cause of my client's damages.
Thank you. Justices, anything else?
This letter number, Exhibit 52, I mean, this is April 2020. This is shortly after, I guess that's a year after COVID.
No, COVID was March of 2020.
It was 2020.
And so, March 17th, Your Honor, excuse me for interrupting. March 17th is when we got the first email, and that is Exhibit 30. It's not in the binder, but Exhibit 30 is an email written in Spanish that was translated for the jury. And basically, Ms. Saida Barrera is telling my clients, look, you're going to have to take a Friday in 2020, because if we get into 2021, you lose your money. Her words were totalmente, totally, as per the contract. And that's where the unconscionability continues. Is she sending an email because she's interpreting the contract as saying they get to keep the money no matter what because of that clause in on page 7, and that's not what it says.
And that that email and that in this letter are written and sent because of the COVID.
Yes, sir. Okay. Well, thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
If I might say, I think that there is perhaps a misunderstanding or a failure to see the case the same way because of the fact that Mr. Franz is arguing that his client should recover because we did not outline and put in bold and whatever the issue that if the failure to, if that there would be a waiver of a right to reimbursement if Gala canceled. And that's totally irrelevant. Gala never canceled this contract. And Gala, he keeps saying, they said, oh, you're out, you lose, you're out, you're lose. They never said that either. They said, we can't go forward in May because of the stay-in-place order, but we'll give you these dates in the summer. You don't like those dates? You want a Saturday? We'll give you February of 2021. They remained ready, willing, and able to perform at all times. So the problem with his argument is that there was no damage that resulted from anything having to do with this waiver argument. They were never intending to recover on the waiver argument. They did not assert the waiver argument. They did not say anything like that. But then what came second was they provided a Saturday date that no charge. They gave them everything that they wanted. And then the appellees canceled. The appellees said, we're not going forward. We want to get married in Cancun. So who canceled this contract? It was not Gala. And the waiver relates to when Gala cancels, they should not be allowed to keep the money. We agree. They never tried to do that. So any evidence about that as an unconscionable course of conduct is totally irrelevant and totally immaterial because that never happened. And the DTPA letter of April 2020 only gave the list of laundry list. The laundry list of items never said that you are engaged in an unconscionable course of conduct as defined by 17.50A3. And so they did not make their claim that the notice letter was adequate. The appellees are complaining they were forced to waive their DTPA claims, but they were not forced to waive their DTPA claims because they went to trial on their DTPA claims. They suffered no loss as a result of any waiver argument because they were allowed to try their claims, the two that were left, false, misleading, or deceptive practice, and the unconscionable course of conduct.
Going back to the DTPA notice letter, what was deficient in your view that would prevent or preclude the recovery of attorney's fees?
Recovery of attorney's fee. Oh, that they should have been required to specify the sections of the DTPA that they were relying on. And they never did mention 1750A3. They only mentioned the laundry list. But also remember that in terms of the attorney's fees, that he's trying to say, well, we had a right to cross-examine. That is not what's required. If you write a pleading in a multi-theory case, You have to segregate how much of your pleading time. If it took you 4 hours to write a pleading, you need to say 2 hours was on recoverable claims, 2 hours was not. Remember, they were also suing us for conversion, on which there are not attorney's fees that are recoverable, and other theories. And then they got instructed out on most of their theories. But Victor Barrera was a prevailing party. He was deprived of his court costs. And the answer to Judge Fontex's claim is a question was the fact that Victor Barrera was non-suited after the trial. He was never dismissed until there was a non-suit, and the non-suit, the court refused to give him a take-nothing judgment. He granted a non-suit without prejudice so that Victor could be sued again. So both appellees testified that they were told that they would forfeit the payments if they failed to proceed. They were given full advice about what was going on. And the other issue is that there was no producing cause. That language, that contract, never was imposed, and they never lost anything as a result of the contract, other than when they refused to go forward. And remember that the reverse and render is appropriate in our view because of those posters that were left up on the wall until the closing argument, implying that failure to have that waiver language was an unconscionable course of conduct, when then the court said, well, no, it's really not, you know, that it was an improper exhibit. But the defense of impossibility was conclusively established, and our people continued to reschedule. Take a look at the case of Haykill versus NCL Bahamas that says unconscionable cancellation policies can be upheld. It also says that having a harsh cancellation provision does not make it illusory. And the Tony Gullo case says you don't get attorney's fees on things that are not authorized by statute or contract, and you must segregate in order to recover. It would be our position that the court should reverse and render and grant a take nothing judgment.
Counsel, if I could just ask.
Sure.
This is an aside from the arguments. Has this case been mediated?
I don't know.
Pre-trial, it was mediated.
This looks like a ripe case for mediation. If we were to order that, would that be something that y'all would welcomely receive, or what are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts is that if it's a good faith mediation, we appeared at a mediation in good faith, and forgive me for getting into something not on the record, but their clients refused to see my presentation and walked out of Sofia Ramon's office in McAllen without listening to my presentation and refused. And so I never object to mediation, but my experience with them is it's their way or the highway.
I have no knowledge of that because I'm appellate counsel. I was not involved, though. But I don't know if there was an interpreter present. I do know that my clients don't speak English. Saida speaks a little bit of English, and Victor speaks none. So I have no idea about those circumstances.
It would be helpful, counsel.
My feeling is that because the attorney's fees have gotten so high and that there's an issue of the attorney being motivated to recover his fees, which I certainly understand, we work both sides, that it would be very hard to settle.
Very good.
But I welcome any order from the court.
Well, for the moment, we suggest it, but that's not an order. That'll come later if it does at all.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was enjoyable to be in the new courtroom.
Thank you.